Good morning.
Replace your golden memories, classic every time, the golden hour.
And first of all, today we go back to 1973 and the sweets.
I always loved music. Yeah, yeah. Music was the thing that I really loved from the time I was a little fella. I remember going to buy my first record and all that kind of thing, you know, going down to Drap Mines to the record shop and saving up to buy a record and that kind of thing. And I loved Elvis, you know, when I was young. Still to this day, love to hear new music. I love to hear new Irish bands, you know, and there's something great about it. I think if I didn't like it, I'd give it up, you know, but I love it. I love the business. I love listening to new music, and I love playing the oldies as well, of course, you know, so the combination of both of them seems to go down well.
Larry's Just a Minute Quiz.
The ones that really sound out of, where's the Taj Mahal? Up to the dental hospital. There was an Indian restaurant there, and the same thing with Where's the Great Wall? Crumlin.
Somebody was asked, can you divide 48 by 16? To which the answer was yes. Did that happen?
Those things happen all right.
Tuesday's Morning Ireland, giving us a flavour of the late, great Larry Gogan, who died this week. And we'll hear more tributes to Larry later on Playback. How best to remember our complex and troubled past was a topic that dominated much of the start of the week. An event had been planned in Dublin Castle later this month to commemorate the place of the Royal Irish Constabulary and Dublin Metropolitan Police in Irish history. But this prompted some very heated debate, and 100 years on, the hurt on all sides was really just under the surface. On Monday's Liveline, Katie Hannon spoke to two men with very different points of view. First up, Tom.
Are we the only country in the world that commemorates people like this? The RIC, in order to become a member of the RIC, firstly you had to swear an oath of allegiance to the Crown Forces and to the Crown in the United Kingdom. The second thing is, do the Germans commemorate the SS? Do the British commemorate the German pilots that were shot down over Britain during the Second World War? Do the North Vietnamese commemorate the 53,000 Americans that were killed? Are we crazy? Absolutely crazy, commemorating people who were an enemy of the state, or at least the attempt to create a state. I think it's absolutely crazy. It's ridiculous.
Katie then brought in Jim Herlihy of the Historical and Reconciliatory Police Society.
No, what's happening at this stage is people are talking about revisionism. When it comes to the RIC, something has to happen before it's revised. The RIC have been airbrushed completely out of history. And you take
thankfully,
1913, the decade of centenaries, up to the present day, there were 17 policemen killed in 1916, and there was absolutely nothing done commemorating those men. And the half commemorate those men that were killed in 1916. And just the statistics alone, the manner in which the policemen were killed, overdoing it is absolutely phenomenal. It's like the elephant in the room with the amount of casualties. 525 policemen killed during the War of Independence.
The amount of torture and so-called questioning by RIC and auxiliary black and tans who were actually working with the RIC, not the British Army, they were working with the RIC. The amount of torture, the amount of rape, the amount of amount of towns burnt out by these people. Why aren't we remembering this instead of remembering people who fought against the wishes of the Irish people for freedom from the United Kingdom?
I'm not condoning that for 1 minute. Just let me give it the example.
Okay, Tom, let Jim come back in there, Tom. Yes, Jim.
Shot out cycling on cycle patrols, didn't go into court. When they were on foot, 80 of them were shot, walking to and from their barracks, attending church, seeking the assistance of a priest, seeking the assistance after the shooting incident, returning home from funerals of their colleagues, preventing a burglary or visiting a doctor. And a further 70 were assassinated, six in shops, 14 in pubs,
Heinrich
six
Himmler
in hotels.
Heinrich Himmler had a huge funeral. When SS troops were shot by Polish resistance or French resistance, they had huge funerals as well. So what?
We're talking about 439 Irishmen killed by the SS.
Do we commemorate the SS because the RIC were no better than the SS? They were no better. They were working in league with the British and working with Crown forces to murder, to interrogate and to torture their own people. So commemorate them. Ah, to hell with that.
Liveline on Monday with Katie Hannan. And that's just a flavour of a programme where people recalled stories of grandparents who'd worked in the RIC to raise their families and, in their view, help provide law and order. And others who spoke of their family's history as victims of state violence and oppression. And on Tuesday...
And the news just breaking that the government has decided, the Minister for Justice, to defer the proposed commemoration of the RIC due to take place on Friday week at Dublin Castle. We'll be speaking after...
Mary then spoke to historian Dermot Ferriter, member of the Expert Advisory Group for the Decade of Centenaries.
Do you welcome that decision?
Very much so. This had become a political football. It reminded me of an argument that went on as far back as the 1930s between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil about the 1916 Rising and who should be invited to the commemorative events and who should take charge of the commemoration. And a contemporary newspaper editorialised that it was always unseemly, if not indecent, for political parties to engage in a figurative scramble for the bones of the dead. And those words were ringing in my ears over the last 48 hours or so. The whole point, of course, of looking at these formal state events is that they can be dignified, they can be appropriate in tone, and they can be measured. And this was shaping up to be anything but.
But Mary Wilson wondered if it might be possible to take a different approach.
Can we not separate in our heads the RIC and the Dublin Metropolitan Police from the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries? Separate them out?
Yes, that's exactly what we should be doing. But the kind of ceremony that was proposed was not going to facilitate that because this is about, you know, a collective remembrance of that particular group. And of course, that particular group, I mean, the force was augmented, as we know, by the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries. It wasn't going to lend itself to that, which is why what we had in mind in relation to commemorating the Royal Irish Constabulary was something much more nuanced, that you could get people together to debate and discuss and to look at perspectives and evidence, and also to acknowledge those who have quietly been commemorating the RIC by trying to establish who they were, how they died, how many died.
But whether you do what you're saying, Dermot, or whether you do what the government was proposing, you are commemorating.
You are commemorating, yes. What we're taking issue with is the way in which you commemorate.
Is it the location? Is it that it's a state event?
I don't think the location was appropriate either. Why should it be done in Dublin Castle and all that that represents for that period of history? We looked at Dublin Castle when the Queen came in 2011 as being an entirely appropriate venue because it was about the assertion of our sovereignty and diplomatic equality. But Dublin Castle for a ceremony to commemorate the RIC from that period is a different entity. The other point to make, of course, is that we've constantly emphasised that commemorations need to be driven locally.
Not a national event?
Well, what we were suggesting is that there should be a national conference, for example, on policing. No, because if we are specific enough, then we will be accused, of course, of trying to dictate how the government should commemorate. All we are doing is offering advice. It's not up for us to come up with specific menu of options.
Kind of back to square one now. I mean, they've deferred it.
No, we're not back to square one, and I'll tell you why. Because it's been recognised now that we have to tread very, very carefully during the next couple of years. I frequently heard it asserted that it's going to be really difficult to commemorate the Civil War.
Well, and I was
people were glossing over the War of Independence as if that would be easy.
If we've got this excited over the RIC, what is it going to be like when we get to the Civil War?
Well, maybe lessons will be learned.
Ooh, let's hope so. Well, that was historian Dermot Ferriter on Drive Time on Tuesday. On Mooney Goes Wild, it was slug time, or more specifically...
Geomalacus maculosus.
That'd be the Kerry slug to you and me. Here's Dr. Aidan O'Hanlon, Curator of Entomology in the Natural History Division at the National Museum of Ireland.
Aidan, what is so special about the Kerry slug?
It's special because it's extremely rare globally. It only occurs in a small pocket of the southwest of Ireland and northwestern Iberia. And at the time that it was included on the Habitats Directive, there were indications that populations in Iberia and northern Spain and Portugal were in decline. We now know that Irish populations of the Kerry slug seem to be in favourable status, at least according to the last MPWS Article 17 report.
And who would take issue with that? But how do you know it's a Kerry slug you're dealing with? Well, they're wily and crafty and good at slithering out of tight spots. Here's Aine and Ilona.
The one way of knowing a Kerry slug, apparently, I'm told, is you gather one as a specimen because you want to make sure that it's it. You put it in the matchbox, and when you open the matchbox again, there it is, gone, because it's absolutely able to squeeze itself into two dimensions, so it can slither out of the tiny little crack where the matchbox drawer closes, and no other slug is able to do that. Is that actually true?
They're definitely good at escaping. Myself and colleagues, we used to do behavioural experiments on them in our lab over in the Applied Ecology Unit in NUI Galway. And as part of that was we had this lovely sophisticated camera set up to track their behaviour. And we were interested in all sorts of things, but this would just sort of track their movement and we could manipulate experiments then. And they always escaped. And of course, that was in Galway and we were always worried that...
They're going to catch them on the camera escaping.
You would, yeah, but it's already too late because you'd leave them in a room with the camera on and go back later on and find, oh no, it's not in the arena.
There they are gone.
There they are gone. We'd always find them again, but we were always worried that because those experiments were in Galway, that if it shows up in Galway then we've accidentally introduced a protected species onto the campus. But luckily we haven't found it there. We always recover
them. So they're indicators of ancient wood.
Well, protected species or not, though populations are increasing. So might the famed Kerry self-sufficiency have something to do with this?
These can bend over and do it to themselves, can they really?
They can, yeah. So all, as you said, all slugs and snails, terrestrial slugs and snails, are simultaneously hermaphroditic. Apparently, most slugs and snails will choose to outcross, will find a mating partner. But there's enough experimental work done, not with Kerry slugs, but with other slug species, that shows that they need a social cue. So if they're in an environment where they can't find another slug or snail, seemingly that's when they'll choose to self-fertilise and essentially produce clones of themselves.
Oh, there's definitely a Kerry man joke in there somewhere. But cheap titters aside, they're fascinating creatures, as this captive breeding experiment by Dr. Aidan O'Hanlon demonstrates.
I read a paper that was somebody from the UK was looking at pond snails, and they had a great captive breeding system. It was so easy. They gave the snails in captivity, they kept them in small lunch boxes and gave them everything they needed. So they had a full balanced diet, they had nice little shelters, and the only thing they were missing was any sort of a social element. So they'd separate them out individually into their own little containers for a period of about 2 months. And then when they put them back in together, the only new stimulus they had was other individuals of the same species. So they got into a breeding frenzy. And I thought, that's grand. I'll try that with the Kerry slugs. And I spent about 2 months just separating them out, keeping them all in individual containers.
Mine's 2 months later, the crossroads, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. 2 months later, put them back in. Again, just a pair of two slugs. Watched them for another couple of months and nothing happened. And I go, all right, I'll give up. Eventually gave up, and then I sort of put them back into, I was keeping them in containers with more than about five slugs, I think it was. And as soon as I got them back into their big mixed containers, I went to check them one day and there were eggs everywhere. So I don't know if the experiment worked. Or
so they want to be at a dance. They don't want just an intimate relationship at deux.
Yeah.
So they prefer the disco scene.
To use the scientific term, that was Aine and Ilona and Dr. Aidan O'Hanlon on Mooney Goes Wild. On Thursday, there were some happy and rather fortunate hurlers in Ballyragget, County Kilkenny.
I think it'd be fair to say the opening story today is a milestone for women in the GA world, because Kilkenny Camogie legend Anne Downey is to take charge of the Ballyragget men's hurling team for this season. There may be another woman in charge of a men's first team in the. I'm not aware of one, but.
But significant though that it's Kilkenny. It's Kilkenny.
The heartland of hurling. And now, having said that, there's no man can match the credentials, except Brian Cody maybe, the credentials of Anne Downey, because Kilkenny have won 13 All-Ireland Camogie titles. She was involved in all 13. She played in 12 of them and was the manager for the other ones.
So they're lucky to have her.
They're lucky to have her, but this could be a first step towards more women taking charge of men's teams and making more men look at women as potential managers. Meanwhile, two more women have been added to the board of the FAI. The FAI last night confirmed...
Thursday's Morning Ireland. Now, we do love a bit of property here in Ireland, and the man responsible for us casually throwing around phrases like flow and double height space is Dermot Bannon. His own house now features on Room to Improve, and he spoke to Ray Darcy, and it's fair to say that Dermy is finding the whole thing quite excruciating.
651,000 people watched it last night.
Oh, it's embarrassing, isn't it?
It's not embarrassing. Well done, congratulations.
I know, but I kind of they did see
Vulnerable and Exposed.
And I found it hard to watch at times because I forgot. Like a lot of that I filmed a year ago, and when we moved out of the house, and there's a couple of there's more next week, and it's raw again. because look, it's about something very personal about my dad and the garden and the involvement of family members, and I got a bit overwhelmed by it. But because I don't believe in that on television, you know, the kind of the gratuitous stuff. So I'm always have a believer of not just turning it on for sake. So last night when you did see it, it was
real.
Well, it's just kind of come on, move on now. But that's the way it was. But I knew. Like in order, because the family weren't involved, I knew that I had to show what was, you know, the others.
The conduit for their feelings.
The debates, the arguments, the discussions, they were all going on in my head. So I had to get
I see that there wasn't a family involved.
No, so I needed to give more of myself.
Yes.
In order to compensate for not having a family. But I knew that going into it. And I found, like, I'm finding this incredibly uncomfortable the whole weekend. And because it is, like, normally you have a client to hide behind. Like, normally when I'm on with you, you're telling me, do you remember this client?
There's a triangulation.
And I'm only one part of it, I'm nearly all three parts of it.
Yes.
And I'm finding that a bit vulnerable is the word, and also just a little bit, oh God.
Architecture palpitations there from Dermot Bannon. Now, he may be high priest of the open plan, but perhaps less so king of the abacus.
You said last night you had 350,000, and then within 2 minutes you had 600,000 to spend. And
I didn't have 600.
Well, that's what we were told last night.
That's what has been implied, but I didn't spend that. And you have to wait to see what I did it for next week.
And wait we shall, but budget smudget Bannon explained why it was important for him to do this project now.
You know, you've got a window in your life when the kids are at a certain age where a family home needs to be a certain size and it needs to do so much. You won't need it when you're older. You don't need it when you're younger. So I kind of decided to stretch myself for the next 10 to 15 years while the kids are still with us. And then, you know, pay for it later. No point in saving and then building all this when I'm 65 or 70 and the kids have all moved out. Because that's my dad finally had money when he hit his 60s. And he said, look, all of you got through college. We've paid off the mortgage. And now I don't know what to spend it on. And then, unfortunately, he died in his 60s. So I kind of taking that with me. This is when we need, this is when my daughter's starting to bring her friends home, where the kids need space. I want it to be a family home that there's hundreds of teenagers, kids, whatever. I don't care, because I want it to be their home. And we need the space now. So it is more for them.
But a little bit for me too. That was Dermot Bannon with Ray. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Well, it was a tense will they, won't they week for the political animals amongst us.
Is there an election imminent in your view?
Well, I'm out canvassing at the moment. I'm sure Donoghue is as well. It's coming, whether it's next week or next month or the month after. It's here, Sean. It's here and it's now.
Ooh, it's on, all right. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but sometime soon. That was Fine Gael's Fergus O'Dowd with Sean on Wednesday. By Thursday, things were hotting up, not least in the analogy department. Here are Independents, Matty McGrath and Michael Healy-Ray.
It's like waiting for the replay of an All-Ireland. The first All-Ireland is a replay, and there's a big... Okay. The ball needs to be turned in and the white flag raised and let the people decide. They are the ultimate people, and they have lost
Sounds
faith
like
in
you
discomfort.
Want a horse race in Thurles or something like that. But ball turned in and white flag raised.
Michael Lowry, but I do. I will be hunting the hares and the hounds and out on the...
Yeah.
This government
is De Valera's motto.
This government is like a car going down a hill with four ball tyres. They're nearly out of petrol.
And no NCT.
And they have no brakes.
I think
no
we're
NCT
back
to a JD Mac. Okay. Well, in any event, Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar met on Thursday night. Here's Micheál Hahn on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
And Micheál, are we any the wiser this morning about when we might be asked to go to the polls?
No, we're not, but I think some things are becoming clearer, and that is, speaking to many people within the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party last night, the desire within that group for an earlier an election is, if anything, intensifying.
And it's all down to Leo Varadkar.
The question now is, what does the Taoiseach want here? I mean, yesterday he was saying, and he was asked repeatedly, could he guarantee that the Dáil would reconvene next Wednesday? He couldn't give an absolute guarantee on that. And he is the only one, of course, who is capable of doing that. So that would suggest there are still considerations very actively underway. I suppose the question, key question is, does he want an earlier election? And he's the one who's going to have to make that decision.
Ooh, rev her up or just keep her purring in the driveway for a while more. Fiddler Steve Wickham has played with many's a band over the years.
So I was in hog heaven playing in a pop band, really, for want of a better word. And I'm a fiddle player. For God's sake, how do you get away with that?
quite well, as it happens, if the band in question is the Waterboys. And Wickham spoke to Anne-Marie Kelly on Sunday for Songs in My Head about their album Fisherman's Blues and writing this song.
But when you're talking about When We'll Be Married, there's something about that. Obviously, when you have that tune from 1978, right, and it's an old tune, and Mike is singing along with you, there's a playfulness about it, but yet he's getting it. And then when you hear the actual song, you're lost in it because there's a kind of a giddiness to both of you. So you're both obviously reacting to the same kind of thing.
If you listen to When Will We Be Married, there's a kind of a bluesy yearning in it. You know, when will we be married?
Sea shanty, isn't it, or something?
Well, I think there's a blues in the lyric without wanting to overanalyze it.
When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed?
There's a kind of a yearning blues in the lyric, and at that time, you know, I think Mike was going through, was trying to get, he had a girl in sights and he wanted to get married to her. Actually, it was very straightforward. When will we be married? He was literally proposing on a record. And, you know, I was married at the same time, going through, just about to go into a divorce. So there was all that's in the mix. Because we're people, we're humans, and this is part of our reflection that's going on in our lives.
So there's a giddiness because it's real.
Oh, it's very real, yes.
In the same bed. When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed?
Fiddle player Steve Wickham. And if you're trying to learn a musical instrument or standing over your kids as they torturously practice their scales, this little anecdote might encourage you once you get over the initial impulse to smash up the instrument, that is.
I don't know whether I hated it at three, but I do remember smashing it up and breaking it and hiding behind the wardrobe. And I do remember my father finding it, and he bought me a new fiddle for Christmas.
Do you remember that time, a time at that early age, that you realise I actually like this?
I had a moment. I was in the kitchen at home and I was practising my scales or something like that, playing Bach. And I was doing all that and then I started jamming around, and for about 20 minutes I was playing this random music that was coming through my head. I was changed, actually. My relationship changed. I actually liked playing this thing. It was leaving my body, and I was able to get in and get out while the fiddle just played.
Now that'd be the payoff. That was Steve Wickham with Anne-Marie Kelly from Songs in My Head on Sunday. Water featured with Cormac O'Hara on Monday. H2O with its molecules, both quirky and sticky. And make no mistake, it's a chemical. A fact about which UCD's Dr. Shane Bergen feels quite strongly.
A chemical, I say. Not everybody will classify it as a chemical.
Yeah, I suppose, as a scientist, I just think immediately water is a chemical. Yes, chemical has kind of taken on this nomenclature now, hasn't it, in the public discourse. People think chemicals are bad, you know, chemical-free. I see this everywhere. And it's just like, nothing is chemical-free, you know. If you live in a chemical-free world, you're dead. So water is a chemical, and we'd know it as H2O. We learned that in school. So it means there's one oxygen atom, and it's surrounded by two hydrogens, and that's where we get the term H2O. Mm-hmm. And whilst it's everywhere, we live on a water planet, and whilst we know it is essential for us and our planet to survive, we also know, as scientists, that it's very unusual. It's quirky. So it's quirky because of the way it's constructed. So I mentioned this H2O, and so water is shaped like a V. So you have this oxygen, and you have two legs coming off it, and your two hydrogens stuck onto it. And you also have, I suppose, this orientation between all of the individual water molecules and their friends. ends. And so they're loosely connected to each other. And so it makes water very sticky. So it gives it very unusual chemical and physical properties. So it's able to do things that other chemicals can't do. It's most unusual that you have liquid molecules at room temperature. And so we're blessed because we've evolved because water is on the earth.
Oh, hooray for water. And we are mostly water, so hooray for us. And for a very good reason, it seems. It keeps us warm and toasty.
We are made up of 60% water. And I thought to myself the other day, where is that in you? You know, so all of our cells are made up of water. I think one of the kind of the quirkiest reasons that we're made of water is to keep us warm. So we're like a hot water bottle. So water has, as I mentioned, unusual properties. So when you heat it up, it's able to stay warm for ages. And so you're going around staying warm. Your core temperature should be around 37 degrees. And because you're a water person, you'll be able to stay warm.
And of course, we also sweat, which in turn has allowed us to evolve. Better than dogs, anyway.
Your dog pants to cool down. They can't sweat in the way we can sweat. And so that means if you bring your dog for a run, after, I better get this figure right, but I think it's about 20K, the dog's going to keel over, right? Where humans, if they're fit, they can keep going. And this is one of our greatest evolutionary advances, is that we can hunt by running at long for a long, long, long time.
So we could, as human beings, outrun the antelope.
Water, quite fascinating. And then Cormac asked this.
Is water blue, as they say?
Yes and no. So so I'm looking again, bottle of water here, it's transparent. But if you have enough of it, like a very, very deep vat of water, it does slightly absorb light in the right part of the spectrum for it to look a little bit greeny blue.
OK, you're worse than a politician. Yes and no is the answer. OK, Dr. Shane Bergen, thank you very much indeed.
Scientists with their yes, no and maybe. That was Cormac on Monday. Tanya Carroll is a leader on Operation Transformation, and she spoke to Ray Darcy about how she's finding things 3 days into her new health regime and her withdrawal from Coca-Cola.
Coke's your thing. You've mentioned it a few times already.
Yeah.
Now, how big a thing
you
is it?
Tell I'm missing it already.
Are you?
Oh, big time. Yeah. I'm over the headache part today. I'm craving it.
Right. So how long are you off it?
Since Sunday night.
What sort of habit was it?
It's desperate because
no, how many cans would you drink in a day?
Well, I'm saying maybe 6 to 8, but being realistic and honest about it, some days I could go up to 12 cans.
12 cans of Coke?
Yeah.
12 cans of Coke.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Do you know how many grams of sugar there's in a can of Coke? How many?
I think there's like 12 spoons of sugar in each can.
Yeah, 39 grams. Yeah. And your RDA, your recommended daily allowance is 30 grams. So there's more sugar in one can.
If you told me, I have my daily intake, like, so for over 2 weeks, I have it in one day. And that's just of Coke.
You have your 2 weekly recommended daily intake forever.
In one day. Yeah.
Whew, that's a lot of fizz. Well, Ray wondered how she was getting on.
In speaking to people over the years who signed up for Operation Transformation, it's all, you know, in the future, and it's not real. But now it's real for you, and you haven't had a can of Coke in 3 days, and that's the first time in how long?
A long time.
Like years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I'm proud of myself for even going this 3 days, and I know I'll carry it on. I don't want to go back to the way I was. I don't want to go back being tired, and do you know, I want to be a role model for my kids, not being the lazy mom. Do you know, I want them to be proud of me as well and show them as well that it's okay, do you know, to want to get help. Do you know, it's okay to be different. Mm.
An impressive Tanya Carroll from Operation Transformation with Ray. Back in a bit. Welcome back. This week saw exceptionally high numbers of people on our trolleys and A&Es around the country, and threats of a no-confidence motion in Minister for Health Simon Harris swirled in political circles. By Wednesday, numbers on trolleys had come down, but were still much higher than figures this time last year. Sean O'Rourke spoke to Dr. Conor Deasy, consultant in emergency medicine at Cork University Hospital.
You are quoted in the Irish Examiner today as saying, "I haven't witnessed the likes of this when I've worked in the third world. These are third world conditions." Are you being a bit
exaggerating or hyperbolic in that.
I don't think I am, Sean. I think what, in terms of what we're seeing on the corridor, we're seeing patients that are head to toe lined up on the corridor on trolleys. These are frail elderly patients who are in their 80s, who are in the worst stage of their journey to recovery, in that they're in the acute stage. They're in the first 8 to 12 hours of their recovery journey. And we know that that corridor medicine is dangerous. We know that treating patients in overcrowded emergency departments has a fatality associated with it, has a mortality associated with it. So I've been at a conference recently where that mortality is stated as being that for every 30 patients that spend greater than 8 hours in the emergency department, we have a death. Okay? So that they're stark figures. And I certainly would not want the public to think that this should be accepted as being normal, and I would want the public to challenge their politicians on this and say that we as a people will not accept this for our older people, for our frail elderly. They deserve better.
Dr. Conor DC at Cork University Hospital with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. Emer McLysett and Sarah Breen performed an extract from their book Once, Twice, Three Times in Aisling for a Nollaig na Mann special. Aisling, bridesmaid for her friend Magella, was on the WhatsApp group trying to organise the Hen from Hell via Tenerife.
Good news, girls. The flights are booked and the Willy Zogabongs have arrived. They're more 3D than I anticipated, so I do apologise for any offence caused. Mortified emoji. Can anyone who still hasn't paid their deposit just pop it into my account? Thanks. Crying laughing emoji.
Will the food there be very spicy, Aisling?
Aunt Shirley. I put the phone down for my mental health and poured myself a glass of Pinot Gris. When I came back, there were 78 WhatsApp notifications.
When are we wearing the T-shirts?
Dervla wanted to know.
Is the activity costing extra? I hadn't budgeted for extras.
Two guesses who that was.
Finula. What's the activity, Ash?
Denise Kelly.
You know, we did archery, a cookery class, zip lining and a makeup masterclass over just 2 days at my hen.
Dee Ruan ended up having to leave early due to exhaustion. I have a few ideas lined up. Shush emoji, aubergine emoji.
Ding!
Good news, girls, the Willy straws have arrived. The balls are very big, I do apologise. Only three more sleeps. Plain emoji, palm tree emoji. I have to admit, my hands were shaking doing those last few emojis. 3 days to go and some people seemed horrifyingly unaware of what you can and can't bring on a plane.
But it's only a litre of Tresemme, it's not a bomb.
Guess who?
Put it in your check bag if you want to bring it so much, Aunt Shirley.
My nerves.
When was the last time you were even on a plane, Aunt Shirley?
That was Bridget.
The year I went to Lourdes, 1979. Ding!
Good news, girls. The Willy Wands have arrived, ready for us to wave at our bride, Magella. I must say, I wasn't expecting the glitter and the fluff. We won't be missed anyway. Prosecco emoji, aubergine emoji.
Ding!
Bad news, girls. The Willy water pistols have arrived, and they are startlingly realistic. I don't even know if we'll get them on the plane. Horrified emoji, blind monkey emoji.
Aisling, do you have that list of activities? I have a fierce back on me.
We're taking a pedi bus to an Irish pub, Aunt Shirley. But don't worry, I've ordered a taxi for you.
What's a pedi bus when it's at home?
That's Liz Moran, mother of the bride. It's an open-top, pedal-powered bus that seats 10. Here's a picture of one I found online in an article about the rising number of public order offences in Temple Bar.
Does Tenerife have the Euro?
Denise Kelly.
Will there be films on the plane?
Busty Bernadette.
Has anyone seen my passport?
Aunt Shirley. I put my phone on silent. It was going to be a long weekend.
That was Emer McLysett and Sarah Breen with an extract from their book Once, Twice, Three Times in Aisling on the Nollaig na Mann special with Sinead Gleeson. On Wednesday, Ryan spoke to astronaut Chris Hadfield, a man for whom we have a shocking amount of affection.
Chris Hadfield's one of those people who we just said, we like you, you seem to like us, and let's be friends. It's like a mad international Tinder date that went really well.
Ooh, definite swipe right for Chris. And Ryan went straight in to ask him about the big questions.
What is the most fun thing about space?
Weightlessness. And what is being able to fly, it's like having a superpower. Weightlessness is just a continuous bottomless joy. It's great.
Why is it so, like, you smile like a boy when you say weightlessness. Like, it's amazing
every picture of an astronaut flying around in weightlessness, they have a big goofy childlike grin on their face. You would if we suddenly shut off gravity for just 1 minute in Ireland, and everyone could fly. But the laughter, you could hear it everywhere. It's just, it is so much fun to be released from the oppression of gravity.
Is it addictive? I mean, did you miss it when it wasn't happening?
When you first return home, gravity just seems so unfair. I mean, why are we all crushed into the ground by this invisible authoritarian heel of gravity? It's so nice to be weightless. Yeah. So yeah, you'd love it.
But all the fun aside, it's an extremely dangerous job. So how did his family feel about it all?
And I say this respectfully, and you don't have to answer that from a personal point of view, but can you imagine that around the kitchen table of an astronaut's family, when a spouse would say, 1 in 38 chances of this, of you not coming back from this launch, you are a selfish man. You're taking this risk, you've got these gorgeous children, and who the hell do you think you are?
So I met my wife when she was 14.
Yes.
And we're lucky enough to have, now we just celebrated whatever that is, our 38th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
And have three children and a granddaughter. My wife talked me into it, not out of it, at several stages, because I went through that level of my own personal desires and willingness to take risk, but I'm not an island, I'm not alone. But she said, hey, giving up on your dreams doesn't come for free either. And if this is really important to you, let's just get over the fact that we're all going to die. Everyone's going to die eventually. It's an unavoidable fact of life. The important thing is what do you do while you're alive? And how close can you get to the things that you truly are in your heart and that you dream of? And let's support each other in those. And okay, so if the thing you chose to do has a risk, fine, let's buy life insurance. That's why it exists. You're going to get good at this job. It's probably not going to kill you. But if it does, I mean, people die for foolish reasons as well. If it does, then it's not the end of life for everyone else. It will be sad, but we would also be sad if we said, you can't do what's important to you and what you dream of and live with that. That also is a burr under your saddle for the rest of your life. So I think it's important to not take foolish risk in your life, to be measured in your risk-taking, to share the assumption of risk with the people that are important to you, and to believe in a common set of goals. And it's the overcoming of risk and the accomplishment of complex things that gives a great shared sense of accomplishment. Yeah. You know, doing things together is the real joy of it. And so my wife not only got to share in the risk, but she has had a great chance to share in the joys that come from the result.
It strikes me as like a stoical romance, you know, covering all angles, but in a really lovely way.
Well, she's a very practical woman. She's like, yeah, I don't want to steal his joy.
And then a listener got in touch to say just how much Chris Hadfield's outlook had meant to her.
Mary in Cork is on to say, as a child, I was terrified of space and the darkness and the enormity of it. And when I saw and heard Chris Hadfield on American TV talking about it and the beauty and the miracle of it, I thought how relieved I would have been as a child if someone had spoken about it like that. Thankfully, as I grew up, the fear was replaced by fascination. And Chris Hadfield has a gift for communication, which is charismatic. And I admire him tremendously. So
nice compliment. Lovely. The dark is for dreaming. The dark is where you see the stars. The dark is often where your mind can give you a whole new perspective of thought. So the childlike fear of the unknown and the fear of the dark, that's natural and normal. But finding a way to recognize the beauty and the magic of the velvety black of the darkness, and that's where you can see things that are invisible. Otherwise, I think it's a good process to go through as we grow up.
Astronaut Chris Hadfield with Ryan. Well, we're almost at a finish here on Playback. And again, radio has lost a much-loved voice and a champion of music. On Tuesday, colleagues, friends and listeners paid tribute to the one and only Larry Gogan.
It's been the happiest 40 years. It went so quickly. I enjoyed every single second of it. Not every minute of it, every second of it. I love the business. I always did. I always wanted to be a DJ. I became a DJ. And it's been a complete, very happy ride for me.
If you twist and turn away.
Let's speak to somebody who worked with him closely on RT2FM. Former producer at the station, Ian Wilson, is with us. Morning, Ian.
Morning.
And sad news with the passing of Larry.
Oh, it's incredibly sad. The man was a total gentleman, a complete genius at radio, and there's a tendency among particularly speech broadcasters or people who listen to news junkies, to think that being a disc jockey or playing records is some way easy. I always said, when I was talking to younger presenters and disc jockeys coming in, I said, I could give 50 of you a pile of records and go in and present a radio program, and I guarantee you that nobody would present a program as good as Larry. I defy any of you to beat him at that game. And I think most younger disc jockeys, music people, would accept that. He was just unique.
Go straight to Ronan Collins, actually, because I know Ronan was very close to Larry. Ronan, very good morning to you, and sincere condolences to you.
Thanks, Ryan. Thank you very much indeed. What a joy it was to go into RTE and to search out Larry. We were both on Radio 2. I was there for 6 years. Larry was there for 40 years. He was so encouraging down through the years. But even apart from all the professional stuff and everything, He was such a great friend. He was extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about people in life who are happy, and there's a professional happiness and a professional way of doing things. Larry was never professionally happy. He was personally happy, and he spread that. What a golden voice. Nobody played it and presented it quite like Larry. You know, with Gay going and with Marion, and they were great broadcasting colleagues, and indeed great mentors.
Yes.
But Larry was my friend.
Eleanor McAvoy, good afternoon to you.
In an industry that was very unkind, he was extremely kind. He exuded kindness. He'd always go out, you know, of his way to say hello to you. Writers and musicians loved him because he seemed to love the song, and the genre was irrelevant to him. He didn't care what element of the music business you were in, once it was good. Somebody posted one of his last playlists there, and I saw on it a host of Irish acts from, you know, there was Thin Lizzy and U2 and Boomtown Rats. But he had a segue from Aslan into Joe Dolan into Westlife. Aslan into Joe Dolan into Westlife. You know, very few people could carry that off.
You gotta love that, in fairness. Roddy Doyle, good afternoon to you. Anyone who has lived in Ireland over the last 30 years will remember that there was a dog called Larry Gogan in The Snapper.
There was. There is. And the reason I chose Larry Gogan is because, first of all, he's such a well-known, or was a well-known, such a well-known figure here and much loved. But also because he would have been the only DJ that Jimmy Sr. would have known.
Did Larry object to having a dog named after him?
Apparently not, no. I only met him a few times, but the first time I ever met him, I was in a hotel in New York at the lift, waiting for the doors to open. The doors of the lift opened, and Larry Gogan was at the other side of the doors. He was getting out, I was getting in. The two of us looked at each other and burst out laughing. He was such a nice man, and always a big smile.
FM, Jennifer Zamparelli here. It is 16 minutes past 10. Dave Fanning.
I mean, it's a cliche, but like, he was the nicest guy you would ever meet. He was always up for everything.
Yeah.
He was so friendly. The people who worked with him, like some names right down through the past of, like, he'd be up in the canteen having a coffee with Helen Durley and Kieran McKellen, Nadine Leonard and all those people, etc. More. Like, he really was part of who we all are here, as well as all the DJs and everybody else. There couldn't be possibly one who wouldn't say Larry was wasn't an influence.
Thanks,
not,
Dave.
Not one.
Well, that's just about it for this Golden Hour on 2FM. It's been a fantastic 40 years, and it's time for me to say goodbye. But I'd like to say thank you for your company. For the last time on 2FM, Larry Gogan saying bye-bye to you.